I guess that's your water. I don't know. I drink more water than you all do. Will the committee come to order?
It's February 17th, 1966, day five in a series of public hearings convened by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to question a range of experts on the progress of the Vietnam War. The committee has held hearings before on Vietnam, but never in televised open session. 15 months into the Johnson presidency, the country still knows little about the war. On the rare occasions when the president has spoken of it, he's been less than forthcoming about what he knows and what he's doing. These hearings, for the first time, have parted the curtains. Improbably, they've become a national event, and for Lyndon Johnson, an unwelcome challenge to his conduct of the war. I'm David Brown, and this is LBJ's War, a podcast in six parts from Public Radio International.
We are very pleased this morning to have as our witness General Maxwell D. Taylor, one of the ablest military leaders that we've had in this country in many years.
That's Senator William Fulbright of Arkansas presiding, a venerable figure in the world of Washington politics. Fulbright is probably the most famous senator of his time.
General Taylor, we're very pleased to have you, and we welcome you to make whatever statement you choose.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, thank you for your willingness to hear my views on the situation in South Vietnam.
Maxwell Taylor is a venerable figure in his own right, a four-star general, bona fide war hero, and former ambassador to South Vietnam. He's here today as President Johnson's personal emissary to explain and defend the president's handling of the war.
With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I will undertake to answer three basic questions. First, what are we doing in South Vietnam? Secondly, how are we...
For the next 20 minutes, reading from our prepared text, General Taylor lays out the White House case in stark Cold War terms.
The purpose of the Hanoi camp is perfectly clear and has been since 1954. It is to undermine the position of the United States in Asia and to demonstrate the efficacy of the so-called War of Liberation as a technique for the future expansion of militant communism.
The heart of General Taylor's testimony is a spirited defense of the American bombing of North Vietnam. The air campaign, as Taylor prefers to call it, has been escalating steadily in recent months, and criticism has mounted accordingly.
In a very real sense, the objective of our air campaign is to change the will of the enemy leadership. We hope that in due course, the Hanoi leadership will decide that it is in their interest to halt their aggression and join with us.
The most proximate reason that the hearings took place was Lyndon Johnson's decision to resume bombing North Vietnam.
This is historian Mark Silverstone.
Johnson had instituted that bombing pause really reluctantly. He had been encouraged to do so by a number of his closest advisors, including Bob McNamara.
That's Robert McNamara, LBJ's Secretary of Defense, whose early ardor for the war has recently begun to cool.
McNamara was increasingly dubious about America's ability to prevail militarily in Southeast Asia. By the end of 65, he is encouraging Johnson to think about a bombing pause.
The president shares McNamara's desire to bring North Vietnam to the conference table, but has never been persuaded that a bombing halt will achieve that objective.
Johnson fears that a bombing pause will only allow North Vietnam to infiltrate more men into South Vietnam, and he recognizes that he's going to get incredible heat from conservatives as well as from the military the longer this pause continues.
And so, after 37 days, the president has decided to resume the bombing and has sent General Taylor down to try to get the Congress and the public behind the decision. Taylor's argument, nothing else will work.
There are, of course, the two old alternatives, to withdraw and give up our basic objective, or to widen the war by massive air attacks on the North Vietnamese and even on Chinese targets. These two courses of action we have always rejected, and I hope will continue to reject. The only new proposal of which I am aware is the so-called holding strategy.
The holding strategy, which would pull American ground forces back into small enclaves, was briefly put forward by the Pentagon, but quickly rejected by the president, who 2 weeks earlier had communicated his distaste for the idea to Taylor in a phone call.
If the boys just hunker up in these enclaves like a jackass in a hailstorm and let them shoot at them, why, they're going to be in a hell of shape.
Exactly.
And if they don't try some way to make it hard on them and stop them, why, they're going to kill a bunch of American boys that oughtn't to and die. And the only way you can do that is to try to make them pay enough through attrition that they'll finally say, well, we better talk. And then show them that that's what we're trying to do.
This, in essence, is the message Johnson means to send not only to North Vietnam, but through General Taylor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as Taylor soberly sums it up.
The Hanoi leadership is not yet convinced that it must mend its ways. They doubt the will of the American public to continue the conflict indefinitely until it becomes perfectly clear to them that we are going to stay on course regardless of anything they do. I am afraid we are not likely to see them at a conference table. I subscribe to the words of President Johnson when he said, we will not be defeated, we will not grow tired, we will not withdraw. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Taylor.
At this point, the hearing shifts gears. For the next 2 hours, Taylor will field questions from members of the committee, some friendly, some not, as Chairman Senator Fulbright is first up.
General, not being a military man, as you know, I would not wish to argue about, at this point at least, the strategy. I'm not capable of the strategy of pursuing the war.
Fulbright's manner is courtly and professorial, as always. But in this encounter, the careful neutrality he has displayed as chairman up until now will quickly fall away. LBJ's gradual escalation of the war has happened, in Fulbright's view, without the advice, much less the consent, of Congress.
By the end of 1965, there are 184,000 American troops in Vietnam, and there are plans to introduce upwards of an additional 200,000 troops during 1966.
This is Mark Silverstone again.
As he hears about these numbers of troops going in, Fulbright fears that there is much too much emphasis being placed on the military dimension of the war as opposed to the civil dimension, what was termed pacification, and that we are in the process of moving toward war without end.
I think that there's no question that if we wish to bring all of our power to bear, we can completely annihilate this small country. There are 15 million people, and they're very poor people, are they not? I mean, there's no industrialization of any consequence, and I'm sure we could completely crush them to dust and rubble if we wish to do so. What does worry me is whether or not we are justified in pursuing this course.
I hope my statement has made clear that it is not our objective to crush or destroy North Vietnam. We are trying to change the will of the leadership in Hanoi. I like to quote a sentence from the Greek historian Polybius, who wrote 125 years before Christ. He says, I think very wisely in its application today, it is not the purpose of war to annihilate those who provoke it, but to cause them to mend their ways.
But isn't the origin of this struggle in Vietnam an effort by the Vietnamese people to throw off the colonial domination of the French?
It was, and that was... That
As the argument grows contentious, another senator breaks in.
Keep making speeches while he's trying to answer your question,
sir. I
wonder
if the leader, he isn't leader of this committee, if he'd wait his turn, please.
I'd like to hear the answer to your question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you have your turn to say what you please. You said it yesterday. You can say it again today for the microphone. Continue, General.
I was simply making the point that...
The disruptor is Russell Long of Louisiana, a fellow Democrat, but unlike his chairman, a staunch defender of Johnson's policy on the war. When the day's session is over, Long will telephone the president to report on the altercation.
Mr. President, I hope you saw this show on TV today.
I saw some of it, and I thought you did a good job.
Well, I'd say that Wayne G. Morris and Bill Fulbright have an oversized asshole today. Because if I do sit, I really work them over.
In fact, we know from White House phone calls that the president had a close eye on the proceedings from day one and knew the potential damage they could do his cause.
Johnson's intensely concerned about the criticism he's receiving at the hand of some noted public figures such as George Kennan, the father of containment, and James Gavin.
That's General James Gavin, a former military man as accomplished as Max Taylor, only now turned outspoken critic of the war.
These people who had been pillars of the American establishment had contributed to the formation of America's Cold War national security policy were really criticizing Johnson's approach in Vietnam as misguided. And Johnson sees Fulbright enabling them as unpatriotic. He's a traitor. He's disloyal. And for Johnson, being disloyal was probably the highest crime there was. Once the president had committed, it was the obligation of members of his own party in Congress to line up behind him. And Fulbright is doing just the opposite.
How do you reconcile your views with the statement of General Eisenhower in his book that he thought if an election was held in 1955, that 80% of the people would vote for Ho Chi Minh?
Ho Chi Minh is one of the leaders of North Vietnam and about the only one known in the West.
I would have to find the context in which that was made. I would certainly disagree.
By the time of General Taylor's appearance, LBJ has come to see the hearings as a direct and dangerous assault on his conduct of the war. For 2 weeks, he's watched the administration's defenders like General Taylor come under attack, while critics, in his view, have had a free ride and a chance to make the anti-war case on national television. Johnson is working hard to contain the damage, but there's not much he can do from the sidelines. His defense comes down to a single argument, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which gave the president what he considered virtual free rein to prosecute the war as he saw fit. Congress had passed the resolution 18 months earlier by an overwhelming majority, which included Senator Russell Long. When Long calls in to conspire with the president on how to defend the war in the hearings, Johnson's advice is, go with Tonkin.
You just get that little resolution out there tomorrow and just say, now I think I know what I voted for. I may have made some mistakes and I may have promised more sometimes than I could deliver. But I think when I voted to send hundreds of thousands of men and thousands of those boys from the state of Louisiana, I think I knew what I was voting on. And I just want to tell you, Mr. Rusk, here's what we said.
Mr. Rusk is Dean Rusk, Johnson's Secretary of State, who's scheduled to testify the next day. At this point, Johnson has shifted seamlessly and perhaps unconsciously from offering advice to giving the long pent-up speech that he'd like to make himself but can't in Fulbright's committee room.
We said the United States regards it as vital to its national interest and to world peace, the maintenance of international peace and security in Southeast Asia. And the Congress approves and supports the determination of the President as Commander-in-Chief to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack, not just one, not just nine, every damn one that occurs, against the forces of the United States, and to prevent any further aggression.
Johnson is rolling now and onto a particular sore point. After Congress passed the Tonkin resolution, a number of senators who had voted in favor of the resolution had come to regret and publicly disavow their votes.
Any of you fellas want to terminate it, offer your motion and call a roll. If not, for God's sake, let's all get together and unify and support our men. The president's not running for office. He don't care. He just trying to do the best he can. He inherited all this thing. But let's just cut out our belly aching and quit running. Let's stand up like men and admit that we all voted for this thing. And I knew what I was voting for, and Morse knew what he's voting for.
Senator Wayne Morse was one of the two dissenting votes on Tonkin.
But the rest of them that voted for it now ought to find somebody to blame. Now, I'll tell you who to blame. If there's anybody to blame, it ought to be blamed right here, because this committee reported this resolution 31-1.
For Lyndon Johnson, the sense of betrayal he feels from the Foreign Relations Committee has a personal history. William Fulbright, who has emerged as the war's most influential critic, was once a colleague and friend.
I, of course, became acquainted with him when he came into the Senate.
This is Senator Fulbright in a rare interview recorded after his retirement.
Johnson was a man of great personal force. He's a big man, and he was aggressive and assertive. And we became friends, and especially when I was chairman of the committee and he was majority leader.
Johnson was the supremely competent technician and political operator who knew how to get things through the Senate.
Seth Tillman was Fulbright's aide and chief speechwriter.
Fulbright really didn't have any particular skill about getting things through the Senate. His notion of how you get something through is that you make a speech, you spell out your proposals as clearly and logically as possible and hope somebody will pay attention. And Johnson, by Fulbright's reckoning, was less interested in the substance of legislation than in the mechanics of working the legislation through. So Johnson, in his manner, would you know, Bill is my Secretary of State, and Bill produces the legislation, he would get it through.
He rarely took a position in foreign relations. He didn't consider that he himself had any particular experience or knowledge of foreign relations.
In the early Senate years, Fulbright says,
there were very few people who knew anything about Vietnam. I knew nothing about it in the beginning. We had no interest, no economic or political interest there, and I didn't know anything, and I don't think anybody else did. Certainly the president didn't.
Then, of course, the crucial watershed, or what came to be a crucial watershed, was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And he got very badly burned by that.
Today, most scholars believe the alleged attack on American destroyers that President Johnson used to secure the Tonkin resolution never happened. Doubts about the White House account began to surface soon after. But Congress had already passed the far-reaching resolution, thanks in no small part to a key endorsement from the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, William Fulbright.
He, as chairman of the committee, was asked to get this resolution through the committee and through the Senate, which he readily and, I don't know if I'd say, well, almost enthusiastically did.
I believed what we were told about it in the committee. No one had the skepticism that is essential, I've since discovered. We accepted it. I had no feeling that there would be a disposition to misrepresent what actually happened, that our ships were in the high seas doing what they had a right to do, and there was no intimation of provocation on our part, and that these people just came out and shelled our and attacked our boats, and it was intolerable.
As more intelligence began to emerge about what had or had not happened in the Tonkin Gulf and about the conduct of the war itself, Fulbright's attitude changed dramatically.
When the evidence developed and accumulated and then became quite persuasive that he had been duped, he got pretty mad and he became very skeptical. And from then on, his attitude was, I don't know whether they're lying to me or not. I have to have evidence.
I felt then I had been taken. They weren't trying to stop the war at all. They were trying to win it. What his motives were and what moved him to pursue that policy has always been a mystery to me. I tried what best I could to persuade him not to.
He was trying to influence Johnson, and Johnson, in his style, apparently was going through the motions of being very receptive, you know, the arm on the shoulder stuff, and I value your advice, Bill, but nobody was taking his advice. He wrote him a memorandum, which is on the record now, dated April 5th, 1965, that stated flatly that not only that we ought to disengage, but that there was no fundamental reason in his judgment why we could not accommodate ourselves to a unified communist Vietnam.
I hoped that I could influence him up until that summer of 65, a year after Tonkin. When I decided I couldn't influence him, the only hope I thought would be then to take it public and to have a public discussion of it.
According to Seth Tillman, Fulbright's decision to speak out was strenuously opposed by Lee Williams, the senator's longtime chief of staff.
Lee warned almost passionately against it. I can almost hear his words, don't do this. I understand this man, speaking of Johnson. He'll never forgive you. You will be shattering any semblance of influence you might ever hope to have.
The prediction proved to be right.
Johnson was just enraged. That was the end of Fulbright's influence with Johnson. He struck him from the White House invitation list. They never had a personal relationship again. They went through the motions to some degree of a little bit of formal geniality, but it was the end of their close association. It was the end of their friendship.
Will the committee come to order? We are very pleased this morning to have our distinguished Secretary of State, Mr. Dean Rusk. He's one of the most dedicated and hardworking public servants that I have ever known. I'm always personally pleased to have you, Mr. Secretary, and I enjoy our meetings, even though on occasion we have had a difference of views about some of our public affairs.
On February 18, 1966, the day after General Taylor's appearance, Senator Fulbright is back at his post. Secretary Rusk, the sole witness, will spend 7 hours on the stand, a good deal of it battling with Chairman Fulbright. It will be the hearing's final day.
We're not asking them to surrender a thing, except their appetite to take over South Vietnam by force. We have a series of alliances
Maybe I don't make myself clear. I don't wish to interrupt you, but...
No, please.
The purpose of some of us is to try to get this matter to a conference table.
Right, and that's our purpose, Mr. Chairman.
And how do we go about doing it? We certainly haven't made much progress.
In the end, it will be a long time before much progress is made.
In the short terms, the hearings really did very little to change policy.
A final word from Mark Silverstone.
American troops continued to flow into South Vietnam in great numbers. There would be close to 400,000 troops in Vietnam by the end of 1966. Johnson would intensify the bombing, in fact. By the middle of that year, he would hit Hanoi and Haiphong. On the other hand, in many ways, the hearings legitimize public dissent in a way that America is now able to have a conversation about Vietnam that they hadn't up until that point. As Congress gets back into the game, as more Americans begin to wonder about the propriety of the war, you don't get a plurality of Americans believing that the war is a mistake until August of 1967. But that process begins with the Fulbright hearings of February of 66.
From PRI, this has been LBJ's War. In our next episode, a powerful new voice joins the growing movement against the war.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam.
This episode was written by Steve Atlas, the executive producer. The series producer is Josh Swartz. Associate producer, San San Tam. Creative consultant, Paul Taylor. Researchers, Jason Higgins, Tom Reinstein, and Robert Thompson. Original music by Ellery Kramer. For more info, visit lbjswar.org or find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review in Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the series. Special thanks to Chris Oppie and to the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. Major funding for the project has been provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. I'm David Brown.